Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We all eat. Most of us spend time each week in a grocery store. Food is central to our lives, and yet, how that food gets to us is an afterthought. We walk into the grocery store expecting our favorite foods to be there, from cornflakes to fruits and vegetables to the meat and fish case. Those expectations were shaken, though, at the start of the pandemic as the food supply chain was impacted by the coronavirus. That probably marked the first time we saw grocery store workers as frontline and essential workers. But the pandemic revealed those workers and those we never see who have a hand in growing and harvesting and delivering our food and bringing it to market are all essential workers. You would think that would result in their being showered with appreciation, but that is not the case. Benjamin Lohr spent 5 years exploring various aspects of America's food industry and uncovered some disturbing things about the food distribution system that has increased variety and supply while also lowering prices. The result of that work is his book, The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. And he spoke with us about that last fall. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Your book has been compared to Upton Sinclair's The Jungle, which was perhaps the major force in changing the meatpacking industry. And I'm wondering if you think it's an apt comparison.
Well, I think it's an apt comparison with intention. I think Upton Sinclair famously wrote The Jungle thinking about labor standards and thinking about how he could draw attention to the horrific working conditions in meatpacking plants and missed. And I think there's some quote like, I aim for their mind and hit him in the stomach.
Yeah.
Because most people who read that book walked away with thinking, oh gosh, the meat industry is disgusting and gross, and I don't want to associate that with my plate and what I ingest. And I think this groceries book is also similarly slated as a little bit of a bait and switch of talking about food as a way of talking about bigger issues like labor.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious about that, too, because as you go through this book, you find out some disturbing things about the grocery industry, both in terms of the food itself, but also about the people who bring us our food and how they're regarded and how they're treated. Did you know that before going into this research for this book? Is that why you did it? Or did you find this out over the course of the 5 years that you researched?
No. Yeah, quite the opposite. I walked in knowing very little about the grocery world, except I found it enormously compelling. I have loved grocery stores. I currently love grocery stores. I find walking into a grocery store a miracle. You know, when I travel overseas, I check out the grocery stores overseas. I think there's something about them that's almost hallucinogenic, where you're walking down these aisles and there are these saturated colors, these banks of cereals and all the different varieties. It's both comforting, and I am legitimately soothed by the grocery store, and yet with all that choice, there is a power that kind of radiates from them. And yeah. So I walked into this like, what is this sensation about? That like, I want to just scratch behind that surface. I know there's something interesting whenever there's like this mundane aspect of our world that feels almost trippy.
I'm actually glad to hear you say that. I thought it was just me. Because I like to go grocery shopping, even if I don't buy anything but a loaf of bread. I like doing it. And that is certainly by design, the way they set these up, the way they package foods. But there are some disturbing aspects that you get into in The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. You begin the book at the fish counter of a major grocery store chain in New York City. Workers are doing a deep clean of the fish counter, which should be comforting, I suppose, for most of us who buy fish occasionally. But I have to say, Bet, your description was nauseating, and you underscored the description by mentioning that in the 5 years of research that you conducted for the book, you spent time on fishing boats littered with mashed fish and seaweed roasting in the sun. These are your words. You necropsied chickens looking for signs of disease, and in Thailand, you stood ankle-deep in rotten trash fish on a loading dock on a 90-degree day. One can only imagine what that was like. And you write that, quote, none of it was as fundamentally gross and disturbing as the smell that came out of that fish case in Manhattan, in one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the wealthiest nation in the world. Should we be concerned by that, or are you just making a point that we as consumers are far removed from the realities of what we eat?
Yeah, should we be concerned by that? Absolutely. Probably not, again, for the Upton Sinclair miss the mind and hit the belly reasons. Since I chose that as an entry point because I think it made an apt metaphor for the book as a whole. So I'm working at this fish counter, and we sell beautiful, glorious, hygienic fish on the surface of this fish counter, laid out there the way you tile the fish almost over the ice. And then once every other month, we'd clean the case, and it was this old dysfunctional freezer that would, you know, turn off and on during the day. The ice would slowly melt. Fish would fall through the cracks of it and end up at the bottom. And by the end of the month, it would be this gutter of seafood waste that was horrifying to look at. But there was this 3 feet of ice that was between that gutter and the surface, and the surface was absolutely hygienic, safe to eat. And yet when you started plumbing the depths, you got to this thing that was not just gross and disgusting, but it was freakish in the sense that how could these like set of gills or this like rotting pancreas or these like parts of the fish that, you know, what are they doing down there? And this, the fact that it would just was right beneath our radar, to me, made it a very compelling metaphor for the grocery industry as a whole, yeah, which operates with this very hygienic, appealing surface. And then as you start to plumb down to the bottom of the commodity chain, you realize how much of that rests on exploitation, abuse, suffering, or other forms of exploitation.
And you talk about the workers who have to engage in this practice once every month or so at probably every fish counter in America. Otherwise, it would be unsanitary and untenable and cause all kinds of problems. But these folks have to spell each other because of the smell. They can't just keep doing it for hours on end. They have to really back away for a while. Would you call that?
Well, in full disclosure, that was me. Okay. I worked at several supermarket chains during this book just to get retail experience. I thought I couldn't write this book without that type of first person. You know, I could learn from all the supply chain experts in the world, and I shadowed managers. I followed buyers around on their rounds. I talked to entrepreneurs. I did all that type of research, but I was like, you can't write about the grocery store if you don't spend some time stocking shelves or in this case, cutting up fish. So that was firsthand experience. I was cleaning that fish case.
Did they know you were writing a book about the grocery industry, or would they just see you as an employee?
I think they just saw me as an employee. I told several of my coworkers that I was writing a book. I think everyone just assumed I was crazy and probably writing a book that was only going to be read by me. You know, that's the wonderful thing about telling people the truth when you're a writer. They just dismiss you immediately. I don't think I was like truly Donnie Brasco style undercover. I mentioned it to my coworkers, but I think that they kind of rolled their eyes.
Yeah, like a screenwriter in L.A. I'm working at Schwab's, exactly. But you're a screenwriter.
That's right.
This is not just about the horrors of the fish counter. I don't want to get people off on the wrong foot, but you actually take us through how the grocery industry sees what it is they sell. And you make a pretty clear point early in the book that when it comes to meat products, and for that matter, I guess everything, there is a production chain during which animals become food, and then they become products or SKUs, the shopkeeping units that have little barcodes to, so they can keep track of what they have, merchandise. And then we as consumers convert that back to food. Explain that.
Yeah, I think that one, just talking to the buyers of the world and the managers of the world, they never refer to this as food. They refer to it as product. And I think that is not just a linguistic game. It has shifts in how they think about food. You know, I remember probably the first time this hit home was I talked to an entrepreneur who is advising other entrepreneurs on getting their product on shelves. He said, think like a buyer. Don't think about it as food. It's not food. The buyer doesn't care about food. The buyer cares about all these other qualities that are attached to it, like gross margin, like shelf life, like the underpinnings of the commodity prices. Are they going to jump wildly or are they pretty stable? The recipe that you're using is absolutely one of the third, fourth, or fifth considerations down the line that this buyer is considering when he decides to put this product on shelf. Yet so many young entrepreneurs are caught up in the idea of food. And of course, as consumers, I think when we engage with the system, we engage with it as if these things are food, because that's what it is to us. But to understand the system on the terms that it's operating, it's really unhelpful. And I think we do a good job in our minds and in our critiques of the industry, critiquing it as a system of food. Oh, it's presenting all these unhealthy options. The center aisle never spoils. We do a pretty good job of critiquing it as it exists as ecological creatures, as like before it's meat and it's an animal. I think those are things that register pretty well in our consciousness. But to actually think about it in the terms that the industry operates as product, I think most of us just allied that in our brains and is out of sight, out of mind. That's not even what it is. Those people are making a mistake when they refer to it like that. But that's how the industry thinks about it.
Yeah. The modern supermarket, which we have long thought of, at least in America, as kind of a miracle, and we used to, during the height of the Cold War, when Nikita Khrushchev would come here, we'd take him to the grocery store and just show him what we have that you don't have. And it is the end point, the depot, I suppose, for the entire food system, which has, as you point out, become much less expensive to the consumer over time. Because I remember going to the grocery store with my grandmother and things were too expensive to buy. And now, today, we only spend about 10% of our income on the groceries that we buy. It's been dropping steadily for most of the century. That's the miracle, isn't it? So if that's the miracle, why is there a dark side? Because of the things we have to do to make it cheap?
Yeah. Absolutely. Partly the things that we have to make. And I just want to say, you're almost underselling this miracle, because at turn of the century, your grandparents' grandparents, especially for the younger listeners here, were paying 40% of their budget towards food. And now we're paying under 10% of our budget. So if you can think of an area of your life where 40% of your income was just suddenly freed up and evaporated and you could use that on pursuits. I think there are a legitimate case to be made that the rise of the supermarket and industrial supply chains that make it possible created the middle class, helped create the middle class, along with unions and the GI Bill and a few other like kind of famous structures of the middle class. But like underselling the role of the food is not. And as you said, not just Khrushchev, when Yeltsin came to Texas, he visited a grocery store and felt like, oh my God, I can't let my people know it. This will actually.
We have to break. I'm coming right back with you in just a second. Stay with us.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Benjamin Lohr. He's the author of The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket, which is a fun read and an interesting one, too. And I'm one of the guys who liked Upton Sinclair's The Jungle when I was in high school and read it for the first time. Let's talk about that again for a second, because unlike Upton Sinclair, who reported on lapses and practices in the meatpacking industry in the early 20th century, you have concluded that fundamentally our food system is safe. It's not unsafe. Given all you saw, all you experienced, does that surprise you?
Yeah, no, it doesn't. It doesn't surprise me. I think it is a shift, and I think there's credit to be given there. And I kind of go into some of the ways that food safety is enforced in this country, and it is not enforced in a logical, efficient manner. It is not top-down government regulation, nor is it companies themselves just seizing the reins and doing the right things. There is an army of tort lawyers out there who are ready to sue the bejesus out of any company that makes a food safety violation. And the combination of these tort lawyers, the government regulation, companies doing the right thing for financial incentive, has led to changes in food safety, especially in meat. And I think it's easy, again, to take food safety for granted because and almost fixate on the failures. But we've, you know, food, it's almost impossible to quantify because we don't have the great epidemiological statistics from 200 years ago for food safety deaths. It's hard to put it in context, but food has become so much more dramatically safe, I think, that we've almost lost context that now we're dealing with rounding error issues, even though each food safety death, of course, is a tragedy and a horror. It's the system as a whole is far safer for our efforts.
That's good to know. But then there are also these humane considerations that people have become concerned about in the last 30, 40 years. You toured an egg factory, and you write that you left as you entered, capable at moments of seeing things like the USDA slides depict it, and capable of seeing it like vegans. You say it was not filthy, nor a hellscape. It was instead an intensely alien, highly functional place for animals to live a sad, short life before they are set to die. Now, some people might find that description disturbing, but really, is there another way to satisfy the food needs of this country?
Well, there are a number of different ways we could satisfy the food needs of this country. Absolutely. I don't think that eggs or meat are an essential part, but they are something that people have repeatedly chosen, and they are something that are part and parcel of a lot of Americans' concept of what their diet should be. So operating from that perspective and knowing that the grocery store above all, and if there was just one insight that I took away from this book, it's that the grocery store is really there to serve consumers. It really bucks this narrative of, oh, there are these giant food companies that are kind of greedy, profit hungry places that are serving up plastic food and kind of, you know, like puppet masters of this great system, and we're just victims who kind of have to take what they serve us. Like, that's just not how the grocery part of the food system works at all. It is razor thin margins, 1.5 to 3.5%, and it's there to serve us. So when we think to your question on eggs, grocery is designed, it's going to be designed, if that's the type of thing that's going to be, that's asked for a checkout, it's going to be designed to serve them up. And I think I was surprised, because I've walked around with a lot of image of what factory farms look like, just how much this bucked what I think of, you know, I term in the book is like the hellscape image of a factory farm. It wasn't that. That doesn't mean it was a pretty place. It doesn't mean I'd want a picnic there. I certainly wouldn't, but it did seem like it slammed home the realities of feeding several billion people on planet Earth creates places that are absurd in the way they handle those needs. You know, they're not necessarily evil. And again, I think that's one of the take homes from this book, the way that these acts of service and good intentions can lead to absurd and or dismal abusive places when you get to other sections of the book where I think there's an easier moral line to draw.
You take us to a chicken slaughtering house, essentially, and we forget that when we buy that boneless chicken breast wrapped in plastic and sitting in a styrofoam tray, it was once a chicken. But the people on the line know it is a chicken because they're putting the chickens in there and doing what they have to do to them to get them ready for market. And one of the guys you talked to who was explaining to you the process started crying. Why?
Yeah. and it was noteworthy because these were not tears of sadness or guilt or remorse at his role. This was a man who self-described, I think, supervising the killing of $750 million over his career. So he's a man who'd seen some chicken deaths. And so these tears weren't of remorse. His voice started cracking when he thought of the miracle of civilization and the idea that he watched the moment that this bird strung up by its scaly yellow talons and kind of bleeding out after its carotid artery had been slit, was whisked through a tunnel where it was washed, that its feathers fell out, and it emerges on the other side as this like globe of meat that is then cut up in a completely clean and sterile environment. And for him, that transformation from animal to food product was a miracle, and was something that he was proud of. I think it's a fundamental right of civilization, this movement from bird to food.
So you toured certain places. You worked in a grocery store. Over the 5 years, what else did you do? Who else did you talk to?
Yeah, I did a lot. Fundamental principle of how I write nonfiction, and my first book was on the Bikram yoga world, and which was an obsessive group of yogis who was overseen by this kind of megalomaniacal Trumpian guru who's quite abusive and predatory. It is to get as close as possible to the subject matter. So for that book, I did gobs, unending amounts of yoga, so I could get close to the yogis. For this book, I rode around with a trucker to understand the life of a trucker and understand the systems of logistics that got products to market. As you mentioned, I found activists who would help me break into factory farms. He spent a lot of time with Trader Joe, the founder of Trader Joe's, CEO of that company. And he kind of let him unpack from the bird's eye 30,000 foot view, how a supermarket operates and the decisions he made when founding the chain. I went to Thailand and Myanmar and followed migrants who had been trafficked and forced into labor at the bottom of the Thai seafood supply chain, and really were human slaves imprisoned on boats for years at a time. Wow. And all of it, I really wanted to get as close to the people as possible. I think there are downsides to that approach. Things can become anecdotal, but I think it really can breathe life into a system that is too easily abstracted to get close to the people in it.
We're talking to Benjamin Lohr, who spent 5 years looking at the grocery industry and how food arrives at our table, and his book is called The Secret Life of Groceries. We are all a part of this. We all eat, and all of this is structured so that we can eat, so that we can go to the store, buy stuff that we want when we want it, and go home and dine, so to speak. And you don't let grocery shoppers off the hook. You say that we are skittish and insane. Why?
I think we as a culture have very contradictory, chaotic needs that grocery is trying to serve. The skittish and insane line comes in particular into how we deal with the certain industry truths, and the idea that industry has become extremely scared. What I found when researching this book, let me back up, I guess, is nobody wanted to talk to me at all. It was a top secret industry. And part of that is that, yes, margins are really tight and there are real trade secrets in groceries. But part of that was that the grocery industry itself felt it had been burnt by bad press and by people who were doing bad faith investigations for so long that they weren't taking them on fact. And so a number of like good things were hidden as much as the bad things that were hidden. Hmm. And I think, you know, the skittish and insane line is how I think grocery industry insiders think of consumers. And then I think there is some truth to that in that we often hold ideals of our food they don't make sense. We want the highest possible quantity, the most choice, and the lowest price. And those things don't add up when the technocratic impulses of the grocery industry attacks those, you'll get freakish results. You know, in the book I mentioned pink slime, this like industrial byproduct of industrial beef that, you know, sucking the collagen off the bone and then injecting it back to create more protein matrix in our meat, which, you know, it's both totally disgusting. You know, who wants pink goo collagen matrix in their meat? But at the same time, it lowers the fat content of the meat so they can sell lower fat meat. It is an intense form of, like, you could call it recycling or upcycling this otherwise discarded food product. And so and it creates a cheaper product. Everyone wins, except for those of us who look closely at the pink goo and decide they don't want that in their meat.
And aside from the fact that you say we're skittish and insane and demand more food, more quality, low price, you also say, you layer on top of that, that how we approach shopping for groceries, where we choose to do so, has become an exemplar of our moral virtue and exemplar of our materialism. Explain that.
Yeah, well, that's a deeper concept. It's, you know, I think growing up for me, when I first started browsing the aisles of the giant supermarket in where I grew up, you know, food was food. It wasn't freighted with meaning in the same way. But over the last 30 years or so, there has been an explosion of meaning that has been put into food. And so food now is a cultural signifier in a way that I found really interesting. It you know, it can mean your moral altruism, your ecological altruism. It can express that you want to become like muscly and big, or it can express the fact that you want to be extremely healthy and skinny, or that your connection to your ancestors or to your kin, or the fact that you have a unique colon that requires a certain type of biota, right? All of these signifiers we've kind of implanted on food. And I think it's a really interesting cultural shift in it, you know, food has always had some materialistic overtones. There's this great tradition of what was known as the ante-supper, I think in Victorian England, where the host would throw a party and deck a table with an entire feast, invite the guests over, they'd have them look at this feast, and then he would discard it and put an entire new feast on top of it, you know, in its place. And it was kind of a way of ostentatiously showing off wealth. So that's always been part of food. But now the way we think of class and food has shifted. It is a way of being non-ostentatiously demonstrating your wealth, of demonstrating your education, of your discernment. And the same people who a generation ago would walk around with a Rolex on their wrist, now can flex their cultural capital by knowing the right type of food, shopping at the farmer's market and getting the free range hen, you know, and that was killed the right season. That a lot of this new classicism exists in food in ways that I found really interesting and wanted to explore where that came from, because that certainly wasn't my experience growing up.
There are a lot of ethical concerns surrounding food and how we get it, which we've talked about on this program before. And one of the ones that you really get into are the concerns surrounding the people that make all this happen, from grocery store workers to truckers to farmers to fishermen. It's a challenge for most of those people. Their lives are challenging because of the industry in which they work. And you mentioned a second ago that the folks in Thailand, we get most of our shrimp from Asia. And a lot of the shrimp comes from that area of the world, Thailand. And you say that some of these workers are nothing more than enslaved people. Is that the worst case you encountered?
Yeah, I would say that was, you know, I followed a man who was a migrant. He was trafficked to Thailand. He was then imprisoned. He was forced onto a seafood boat. He was beaten and forced to work on that boat. He was in prison there for 5 years. He watched his best friend get murdered because he wasn't able to keep up with the activity. And I would say that some of the descriptions that he and other Thai migrants told me were among the darkest things that I've heard, even in terms of thinking through the historical record. Of just abusiveness, you know, they really just, they were shocking. They were shocking, and well, that's a word that gets overused.
You point out that shrimp used to be expensive. Today they are cheap, and actually they are a high profit yield item for grocery stores. Is that why? Because essentially the labor is free?
Yeah, it's not entirely why. That's a piece of the story. So if you really want to start tying all this together, and I think in the book we start to do this, it's like if you take that skittish and insane consumer and you take this flex of classism and the way that we now put more signifiers on food, mm-hmm. So like ecological virtue, when something like shrimp jumps into from a seasonal product that's farmed off the Gulf and becomes a commodity product, it gets freighted with all sorts of things that it needs just to enter the global commodity market, right? So a commodity is something that's interchangeable.
Let me stop you there. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more with Benjamin Lohr, The Secret Life of Groceries, right after this at Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking with Benjamin Lohr, who spent 5 years researching and writing The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. And we were talking about shrimp and why they become so inexpensive in comparison to what they used to cost, and the production, the people involved in harvesting those shrimp and bringing them to our store. And I had to interrupt you, so continue, Benjamin.
No. So I think this example of shrimp really ties together a lot of the themes we've been talking about on the show and that are in the book. So it's a really good one to come back to, in the sense that when shrimp became a commodity, and thus becomes an interchangeable good where, you know, it can be stored for 3 months in kind of deep freeze and shuffled all over the world. Because of the skittish and insane consumer demanding certain things, and because of the moral signifiers we've put into food, there are certain qualities that it has to achieve in terms of safety standards, in terms of environmental standards, that it all manufacturers need to hit in order to play the commodity game. At the same time, the first world supermarket buyer is coming to these people year after year and is searching for lowest price and is always asking for a lowest price and never really willing to pay more. Prices don't go up. That's not what happens when you deify the consumer back in America. So they're stuck in a place where one of the few places in their cost structure that they have control of is labor. And it sets up a dynamic where labor is the place where cost cuts occur. And over time, this results in a shrinking of labor standards and eventually the abysmal labor standards that you see in Thailand. So it really is all connected both to our consumer attitudes, to what we expect, to this rise in even things that we think of as maybe being protective or ethical contribute to a world where these good intentions get turned into really terrible things.
Our food gets moved around the country on trucks, and you spent time with a trucker, a female trucker, and trucking used to provide a middle-class lifestyle for the people who drove those trucks. This one person that you spent time with, I think she brings in $200,000 a year, but she nets 70, and so she can't afford to buy a house.
17,
excuse me. Can't afford to buy a house, lives yes. in her truck with her two dogs. Is this just a microcosm of a larger trend, not only in the grocery industry, but in industry at large? Because truckers are being squeezed and soon may be replaced by robot trucks.
Yes. Trucking was one of those places that I think I really had the scales fall from my eyes. Because this is happening in America. It is not something that is happening to traffic migrants from Myanmar to Thailand that I can otherize in a way that's not good, but it's easy to think of that in America conditions would be better. But the same forces that are acting in Thailand are acting on the trucker. And so, yeah, in the 1970s, trucking was a middle class life. It got radically deregulated under Carter and Reagan, which essentially turned the trucker into another piece in the truck that was disposable. And now truckers are working twice as efficiently, twice the measurable output, at 40% of the pay that they were getting in the 1980s. So it is a dramatically squeezed existence. And the trucker I was following with, as you said, was making $17,000 a year, often because of deductions in her paycheck that were out of her control. She would be stuck with just a check for $100 for that week. She was caught in a lease agreement. It was termed an owner-operator agreement, where she was promised that the work she was doing would one day get her own truck. The reality is that very few people in that situation ever saw to the end and got their own truck. They were often squeezed out of the industry before that and then lost all the payments that they had made on that truck up until that point. She was very trapped by this. She couldn't, because of the debt that she had taken out to get this owner-operator agreement, she couldn't shop around between fleets. She was kind of beholden to one and couldn't operate wherever the market dictated. It just set up a system where she was in a debt peonage. And a lot of the truckers I talked to refer to themselves as sharecroppers on wheels. And it sounds dramatic, but I don't think it is. They were beholden to bigger companies because of debt that they were never going to pay off.
Well, let's talk about something good for a second. You spent time, as you said, with the founder of Trader Joe's, and you told Kai Rizdahl on Marketplace that you came away from your conversation with him loving the guy. Trader Joe's is a grocery store that the people who go there love to go to. They feel good about going there. And one of the things they feel good about is the employees that they encountered there who seem to be loving the fact that they're working there. And that could be because Trader Joe's pays them well, provides them benefits. How does Trader Joe, who has now sold that company to the company that owns Aldi's, how has he been able to treat his employees well when other grocery stores marginalize them, at least in terms of the money they make and the hours they keep?
Yeah. So Joe is a fascinating person. He died in February of this year. But he was a true visionary, and he was an iconoclast. He didn't do things the way the rest of the industry did. And in many ways, in Trader Joe's, you can see a rejection of a lot of the cliches around grocery. Grocery stores are premised on continuous goods. They're premised on enormous volumes, all these things we've been talking about over the course of the show. Trader Joe's rejects that, and Trader Joe rejected that. Trader Joe's shrunk down the number of offerings that they had. And so rather than a Costco that's 200,000 square feet and maybe has, or Sam's Club that has 100,000 individual items, like when Trader Joe was structuring the original Trader Joe's back in the mid-60s, he shrunk that down to like 1,500 different items. So like 1/10 of the offerings. And that allowed his buyers to get expertise over his chain. At the same time, I think very simply, just because he was an iconoclast, you know, he didn't want low-paid employees, both for human decency reasons, but also he was kind of, he didn't want to work around people who at the bottom of the labor chain. He was like, life is too short. I want to spend, that is a direct quote. When I asked him why he stuck to this policy of paying people good wages, life is too short. I didn't want to work around low caliber people. I wanted to work around the best people. I wanted to spend time with people who are intelligent and interesting and smart. In the way he makes these decisions to be a decent person seem both personally attractive as well. And in many ways, he applied this type of like lateral thinking to Trader Joe's in a number of different ways. And it was really a joy to watch his mind work. And I think I do a decent job of expressing the kind of idiosyncrasies that he applied to the grocery store.
But you talk about other grocery stores, the major chains, and how the people who work there, either stocking the shelves or behind the meat counter or at the checkout, are at the whim of the company. They have schedules that can change on a dime, and they have to be available or they're out, which makes it impossible for them to get a second part-time job, and they don't make enough really to live on the first-time job, the job at the grocery store. Why does it have to be that way? If Trader Joe can do it, why can't Safeway?
Well, it doesn't have to be that way. It's easier, cheaper, and it aligns with many of the other values in the industry. So human capital management, which is the euphemism for how HR schedules have been changed in the grocery industry into much more of a variable and an unstable place from, you know, in Joe Kalum's day, these were, you'd get your schedule a month ahead or when you signed on the job, and it would basically stay that way. And maybe if someone quit, you would just rearrange your schedule. It was a very human way of thinking about a schedule. That's just not how anything else in grocery operates. The system of logistics that supplies food and parts it changes minute by minute. You don't want excess stock piled up in the back room of your grocery store. And if there's a scarcity or a stock out and an empty shelf, that's a horror to the grocery manager. Well, the same thing can get applied to human beings. And if you have a schedule, you know, if there's a rush of people in the store, you need more employees there to serve them. And if there's nobody around and you have all these employees stocked up and you're paying them, that's an inefficiency that needs to be changed. And so as more big data algorithms have started looking into scheduling, they have adopted the same routines that worked really well for getting product there in an efficient manner to human beings. Of course, this is disgusting. Like, human beings aren't product and we shouldn't be doing this, but you can see how attractive it is for the retail store in terms of finding efficiency and, yes, getting you as a customer a lower price, because those savings are passed on in a business with 1.5 to 3.5% margins.
So this is a business from the farm and the ocean where they catch the fish all the way to the grocery store that is for us, the buyers, the consumers. It's all geared toward us. And we all, as you said, want more choice, more variety, more quantity at a lower price. So for all the things that you discovered about the system that's set up to bring food to us and all the down the pitfalls of that, are we to blame, the end consumer?
Yeah, I think that it's hard to put individual blame on this, but we have set up a system that the incentives are not aligned into creating a just world. And ultimately, the consumer, in our chaotic needs, especially in our non-vocalized needs, not the pieties that we express, but there are actions that we take. So I can say, oh, I hate Amazon. I hate Amazon, but I click on Amazon. I can say, oh, I hate, you know, the grocery store, you know, these terrible things about it, but I, Ben Lohr, who wrote this book, still often go to the grocery store that's directly across the street to me, that's just close and convenient. These unspoken desires that we enact, grocery is very sensitive to them. That's what it responds to. It doesn't respond to what we mouth. And so, yes, until we change our allegiance to convenience and demand for choice, and our shop, you know, preference for low price, these structural problems are here to stay unless we think outside of the system. And that's where it really, where what I encourage people to do. The days of changing things through voting with your dollars, I think, they don't really work. There's too many of these unspoken priorities in our lives around convenience for that to actually be a conduit to change. What we need to do is go back and think outside of the system, strengthen labor, like unions in this country have been ripped into tatters. So strengthen those trade treaties with enforcement teeth, so that there's labor standards. You can't globalize the economy and not globalize protection of laborers. Otherwise, it's just a recipe for unethical behavior. And general poverty programs, like addressing global inequity in Thailand, the people who were trafficked were agents of their own survival. They were fleeing to a better life. The answer isn't to deny them that better life, but maybe alleviate some of the desperation that was putting them in these risky situations.
But wouldn't all of those things cause our prices to go up? And would we as consumers put up with that?
That's the million-dollar question, I think. We may be in a place where we're happy with both being outraged and the low price, which is kind of a gross thing to think about. But we might both like to be outraged about our grocery store and feel moral pride in knowing that it's bad, and also not do anything about it because we secretly love our low-priced food.
Because we're skittish and insane. with all of the complexity, and before we run out of time, I want to talk about this, because hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people are involved in all of this, to getting the food produced and to us and sold to us and stocked on the shelves. But we know, and it works, and it works really well. It's a miracle. You're right. But then during the pandemic, we noticed all of a sudden that things disappeared for quite a while from shelves. And it wasn't just paper products, although that was part of it. There are other things that are still in short supply, it seems to me. Is our food system, supply system, more fragile than we think it is?
It depends what you mean by fragile. I think the idea of Tom Philpott just wrote a book called Perilous Bounty, which points to underlying fragilities in agriculture in terms of drought and flood and topsoil conservation. Yeah, and on those levels, we're real fragile. Some of the practices that we do in agriculture are non-sustainable. In terms of the supply chain itself delivering goods, and if we can forget the problems of agriculture, I think it's actually shockingly robust, and it's built with lots of backups. So
I have 20 seconds left. All the things we've talked about, if somebody reads your book, We All Eat, if we read your book, we are the beneficiaries, the enablers, the raison d'etre for it all. What do you hope we take from reading your book?
I say a healthy appreciation of the miracle and kind of compassion for the lives and the people that make it possible, and then take that and translate it into stronger labor protection.
Benjamin Lohr, our guest, The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket is the name of the book. Thank you so much for the hour.
Hey, thank you. It was a total pleasure. I really appreciated it.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.